yeah. Welcome to the Soulcast. Episode 20 or 30 something. I'm not, you know, I don't care what episode it is. Today's guest is my man Adam Brock. This interview is super informative. When I came into this interview, I thought we'd mainly be just talking about nerdy gardening stuff. But instead, what we ended up talking about a lot is just the culture of permaculture and the concepts behind it, and kind of what goes into the philosophy behind a lot of the work that Adam does. I became introduced to Adam through this project that he is one of the co-founders of called The Grow House. And what The Grow House does is they set up this huge industrial scale greenhouse in the middle of what was a food desert out in part of Denver that the city had largely abandoned. What they do is they provide all these workshops and provide low-cost, organic, healthy food to people in the community, help out farmers, and a lot of what he does is based around permaculture and doing teach-ins and workshops. And I don't know, me personally, I learned a ton just from being around these folks. Adam used to live around the corner from me, and I got a bunch of Jerusalem artichokes from him, and they're still thriving in my yard. But I don't know, it's just, you know, a lot of times when we talk about revolution and what it means, a lot of times it just feels like, you know, we're constantly resisting and we're constantly fighting and smashing our heads against a brick wall. And, one thing that's just a super important part of my practice is gardening, you know, producing my own food, eating my own food, and just having that time to be out in the garden and, you know, getting my hands dirty and having this relationship with the plants around me. And so just this conversation just really, I mean, I just learned so much in such a short period of time, and I hope that you do too. We also talked about his new book called Social Permaculture, 100 Patterns for Transforming Community. His book is, I think it's done and it's coming out in the spring, next spring. So be on the lookout for that. And if you're more interested in what Adam has to say or what he's doing, check out Grow House online or check out his website, peoplepattern.org. And yeah, I don't know, check out this interview. And if you're a gardener, or if you're not, if you've got some property, think about how you can incorporate these permaculture concepts into not only your yard, but your life. And yeah, this music in the background, this is Church Fire. I just put this album out last month. It's fucking incredible. It's such good music. Check out. Adam Brock, how you living, man?
Man, I'm living large. I'm loving life as much as I can in these troubled times.
Nice. So you've lived in Denver a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised here. My elementary school was right downtown when the downtown was, you know, a little bit more hood. And I went to East High School, which is, you know, central. I did leave for college and spent some time out on the East Coast, but yeah, otherwise been in D-Town my whole life.
So you're the founder of The Grow House, correct?
Yeah, I'm one of the co-founders. Can't take all the credit. It's definitely took a village, but yeah, one of the people got it off the ground.
So what is The Grow House?
Yeah, so The Grow House is this organization that we founded in about 2009, based in a half-acre abandoned greenhouse in this neighborhood in Denver called Elyria Swansea. And it's, you know, one of Denver's kind of classic food deserts, neglected by the city. There's two interstate highways that run right through it. Air pollution wise, it's, you know, the dirtiest neighborhood in the state. It's just kind of cut off from the rest of town, immigrant Latino community, that type deal. And so we were able to acquire this half acre greenhouse and turned it around into this hub for food production, food distribution, and food education. So we are growing year-round about 1,500 heads of lettuce every single week and making money selling those and setting some aside to distribute to the neighborhood. We have a corner store kind of, you know, fresh food market in the front where it's kind of this pay what you can deal. So we're buying a lot of food from local farmers and then selling it to folks in the neighborhood at super cheap prices. And then we have this whole big space we call the Growasis. And that's where people come to just get their minds blown and learn about where their food comes from and start growing their own food and learn about food justice. And, you know, we bring in lots of school kids through there. We teach permaculture classes there. We work with people in that neighborhood to give them job opportunities and, you know, all kinds of amazing stuff like that. So it's just been this amazing project that I've been honored to be one of the people helping nourish, and I've certainly learned a lot from it too.
Yeah, and you know, I love how you personally, you know, you make yourself available to people like me or anybody in the city who has annoying questions to ask. You know, you're just like this wealth of information.
Well, hopefully, you know, I always feel like the more I learn, the less I actually know. But at least I can spread some of the things that I have learned from my own experience to other folks in the community trying to do similar work. But yeah, man, I mean, that's totally part of the spirit of organizations like the Grow House is, you know, we definitely are not trying to, keep all this information to ourselves or keep it proprietary. We're in it for the community. This is about spreading as much love, as much knowledge as we can so that there can be a Grow House in every neighborhood, every city. To really get this, you know, revolution off the ground.
You use the word revolution, man.
Uh-oh. Here we go.
Well, one of the things we were talking about earlier is how, you know, a lot of like, you know, and this is like a critique I hear when people talk about revolutionary organizing versus quote unquote activism, where like an activist is reactive and is always, you know, against something. Whereas when you're building revolutionary infrastructure, you're putting forth a positive program, you know, and I feel like that's the main reason I wanted to talk to you today, because A, I just think gardening is such a healthy and fun thing to do, but it's also, you know, a really important tool for, you know, survival moving into the future. Do you have anything to add to that about like what, you know, about the revolutionary struggle and gardening?
Hell yeah. Yeah. I mean, first off, you know, I definitely feel like both are necessary in terms of, you know, the activism of shutting down those systems that are keeping us from all being free and from all connecting to each other in the way that human beings are meant to connect. And I super respect and value and I'm in solidarity with all the people doing that. I know for me, I feel like I get more out of doing the complementary work, the flip side of that work, which is creating, you know, these zones of autonomy, these bubbles of the world that we want to see that are going to make those old structures obsolete. And with gardening in particular, you know, I just feel like we are all so disconnected from the other species around us. I mean, these days we talk a lot about, and for good reason, about how disconnected we are from each other and the oppressions that affect so many other parts of society. But that's not even touching on all the different ways of, you know, the other species around us that we depend on just as much. And so really gardening is a way to tap into that in a very rewarding and visceral way. You know, it's a way to get us out of our screens, out of our news feeds, and out of this kind of headspace and into literally, you know, getting our hands dirty, doing things that we can see are nourishing ourselves and the people around us. And gardening can be the answer to so many things, from you know, jobs to nutrition to beautification to, you know, restoration of our watersheds. And so, you know, not just gardening, but really permaculture in general, which is the kind of discipline that I walk. You know, it's engaging with the earth in so many ways to solve our problems and heal the ecological devastation that's happening too.
When you say heal the ecological devastation, What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's so many depressing statistics out there, right, in terms of, like, you know, if you look at all of the photosynthesis that's happening around the world, around the globe right now, like 50-60% of those leaves are picking up sunlight to be used by humans, usually on an industrial scale, to be turned into crops that, you know, actually aren't very healthy for us. You know, if you look at, by numbers, the most populous mammal species, they're like industrial cows and industrial sheep and, you know, all these livestock. So basically, the humans have turned almost the entire globe into this factory to meet our own needs, to meet this endlessly growing spiral of economic growth that only benefits a few people. So when I talk about healing, I'm talking about remembering the relationship that we've had for the vast majority of our history as a species of being co-creators with ecosystems, right? So it's not this like, you know, romanticized notion of living off of the land, of just taking the bounty. It's actually this very intelligent way of engaging with ecosystems and radically reshaping ecosystems in some cases, but doing it in a way that nourishes us and actually makes those ecosystems better, that increases biodiversity, that increases topsoil, that increases the you know, water table and things like that. And that's the honestly what so many indigenous cultures have been doing for thousands of years, and that what as permaculturalists most of us are trying to relearn bit by bit.
It's really funny because this guy I really like, Mackenzie Wark, when I was interviewing him, one of his quotes was, you know, something like all of nature is interference, you know, just this idea that, you know, nature is just full of booms and busts. You know, and so if we're really going to be caretakers, this isn't what he's saying, I'm just throwing this in there, but if we're really going to be, you know, caretakers of our quote unquote natural habitat, well, A, nothing's natural anymore because the climate, the ecology has been fucked. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of, you know, like bioremediation. You know, I struggle with the median in front of my house, and I can't grow grass on my lawn because it's so hot. So I'm constantly trying to like plant little shrubs and things to like soften it up so that it's cooler on my street, you know, and like things like that. Like, you know, what are some plant, you know, like, is it true sunflowers? You plant a sunflower and it extracts toxins from the ground.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case. It's been proven in a lot of studies. Bioremediation, honestly, I think that's going to be a problem that follows us around for thousands of years, because the things that we've put into the soil, every situation is different depending on what the soil is, what that unique combination of toxins are. There's a lot of citizen science being done around that stuff. And things like sunflowers, actually mushrooms, have the potential to do some really powerful work in healing our soil. But it's not the kind of thing that I think we should just blindly walk into and say, okay, plant some sunflowers and then this stuff is good to eat out of, right? So there's some really good science being done around it, but it's also something that I think we just need to take step by step. And a lot of this work we have to be thinking about it on the time span of generations. And that's another, you know, shift that we have to remember about who we are as a people, that things are not just about, you know, next year, next season. They're not just about our own lifetimes. This is about our grandchildren's grandchildren and the legacy that we're leaving for them.
Right. I mean, for those who don't know what permaculture is, can you describe it and explain it?
Totally. One of my colleagues and mentors is this guy Rafter Sass Ferguson, and I feel like he's come up with the most pithy way of describing permaculture that I've come across yet, and it's meeting human needs while improving ecosystem health. And so, you know, basically that means what are human needs? Obviously the basics of food and shelter and water. So how can we grow our food while improving the ecosystems around us instead of depleting it? How can we build shelter that improves the ecosystem around us, you know, making it out of natural materials, orienting it in a certain way? How can we get our lumber and clothing and things like that? But then there's also these other human needs, right, of culture and collaboration and meaning and belonging. how do we do all of those things in a way that improve ecosystem health? How do we, you know, create songs and ways of economics and governance and all of those things that actually just by definition, by default, actually improve the habitat around us and therefore allow us to continue to exist indefinitely.
Would you consider Earthships to be part of that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like Earthships are on the same tip as the permaculture movement. You know, I think that the people who founded Earthships and continue to build them, they don't identify themselves as permaculturalists, and that's cool. I mean, I say all the time, you don't need to call yourself a permaculturalist. You don't need to agree with that term to be doing this work. What matters is the work. And in many, many respects, what Earthships do in terms of harvesting all their own rainwater, in terms of using recycled materials to build these super insulated structures, of having gray water and black water systems that recycle that water that they're harvesting many times and grow a bunch of food with it, all of that is totally in line with what we talk about in permaculture.
And another thing is I noticed when I went over to your house for that day when you were doing that like demo permaculture garden a couple of years ago, you had dug like you had almost like planted the water flows, like dug things at certain levels so that like water would flow certain ways. And
yeah, I mean, especially, you know, where you and I live here in Colorado, you know, it's you wouldn't know it by looking at the lawns of all these homes, but we live in the desert. And it's probably only going to continue to get more hot and dry as climate change intensifies. And so given that, we need to be really, really thoughtful about how we're working with water and not take any drop for granted. And so that really dictates, you know, the kinds of things that we grow here in Colorado and the way that we grow them. So here in urban areas, we have this amazing opportunity to take all of the water that's falling on our roof and put that to use and store it in the soil. Because, you know, oftentimes the first thing people think about when they think about rainwater is putting it in a big plastic container, right? A cistern. And, you know, cisterns are cool. They have their use. But you can store so much water in the soil of your property than you can in any cistern because it goes so deep and it's, you know, so broad. And so I like to rechannel that rainwater coming from my roof into sunken beds through all these different techniques that, you know, we could get into of like French drains and swales and just, yeah, redirecting it into areas where I want to grow the most food and the food that needs the most water, and then making sure that that soil is holding as much water as possible for as long as possible by carefully deciding what goes into that soil, by putting mulch over the soil so that water doesn't evaporate. You know, it's just all these strategic decisions so that you know, by the time we hit these peak days of 100 degree temperatures in the summer, I could stick my finger in the soil and it won't have rained in 2 weeks and it's still nice and moist in there.
Wow, man. That's so a lot of what is a lot of what you're doing, like informed by these theories of global, you know, the Anthropocene or global warming or even potential collapse.
Yeah, I mean, permaculturists, you know, we definitely take the long view, like I was talking about earlier, thinking in this very long term. And if you look back at the very long term, you know, it's pretty easy to see that this explosion of population and empire and economy that we've seen over the past 200-300 years is directly correlated with fossil fuels. And we all know that fossil fuels are not going to be around indefinitely, probably not for much more than 100 years. And the things that we talk about replacing them, wind turbines, solar panels, those are all great, but they work very different than fossil fuels. And we're never going to be able to do all the things we currently do with fossil fuels with that technology. And so what that means is we need to get used to a much, much lower energy future. And that means not flying things around the world. That's not going to mean delivering our, you know, shit from Amazon by drone. That's going to mean doing things much more locally, and it's going to necessitate us actually getting out of our cars and meeting us face to face and things like that. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, there's going to be a lot of hard things about that. I think a lot of people try and glorify that as this amazing future. You know, I love air conditioning and at certain times, and I love being able to drive into the mountains and go camping, right? There's a lot about this high energy world that I like that, you know, we're not going to have forever. But one way or another, we need to start facing that reality and acknowledging it and preparing now for it and, you know, planting literally the things that are going to feed us when we don't have an unlimited amount of nitrogen-based fertilizers, fossil fuel-based fertilizers, to grow all the food that we're currently growing.
Along those lines, I often hear, or I used to hear the quote that, you know, in order to feed everyone, we would need 3.5 Earths. And, you know, and shit, now that India and China have, you know, increased their quality of life so much, that number is probably like, you know, 7 Earths or something.
Right.
But, you know, for like me, a vegan, you know, or for vegetarians, I mean, is it possible to feed entire cities based on locally grown agriculture? Like, can we support a population of 1 million people here in Denver with locally grown agriculture?
Yes. I have no doubt that it is technically possible. I think the solutions are there. What is currently getting in the way is our culture and the incentives and disincentives of our economic system. So, you know, first off, I think we could feed our entire population technically within the city limits of any city, but I don't think that's actually desirable, because I think there's very important linkages between city and countryside and city people connecting with rural farmers and supporting rural farmers and things like that. So that's, you know, just one thing I wanted to get out of the way. But two, you know, just our current system of the way we grow food and the way, you know, for example, our federal government incentivizes farmers to grow very specific kinds of crops that actually are not very healthy for us. They're just commodities to be bought and sold on these global markets. And it's very hard for small local farmers to compete against that. Not to mention, you know, all of the other things around our economy that create conditions of poverty so that people can't even afford that good food, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of these, you know, interconnected macro issue things that need to change about our greater cultural and economic and political systems before, or I should say side by side with this kind of revolution in our food system.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting what you're saying about, you know, maintaining that relationship between rural and city, because even though maybe if we technically could, why waste all that, you know, why turn cities into islands when
right.
we all have to, you know, inhabit a 30, 40, 100 square mile radius.
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, you know, one way or another, I don't see a future where we maintain as many people on this planet that are not farmers. You know, again, you look back at every single other culture that didn't have this massive influx of fossil fuels, and, you know, anywhere from 25 at best to 95% of the population was engaged somehow in producing food for themselves and for other people. And I think, you know, we can be really intelligent now with our global understanding and our scientific understanding about growing food really efficiently in a way that does restore ecosystems. But even so, it takes a lot of work to do things the right way. When you don't have tractors, when you don't have industrial scale fertilizers and all these machines. And so, you know, whether we're living in the city or not, a lot of us are going to need to be involved in some way, shape, or form in producing the calories that our bodies need to survive.
What do you see is the relationship between kind of like, you know, like indigenous cultures and indigenous values and permaculture?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm sorry to say it's often a contentious one. So just to, you know, back up a little bit, permaculture, this term, this concept, was made up by these two white college-educated Australian dudes in the 70s based on their observations of natural systems and their understanding of ecology, as well as a lot of their observations of indigenous land management practices in Australia and Tasmania. And a lot of those indigenous land management practices were not credited or talked about when they talked about permaculture. And they basically repackaged it and refashioned it for, you know, white Western college educated minds like mine. And so the truth is that every permaculturalist is in deep debt. I mean, every human is in deep debt to these land management practices that indigenous people have been doing all over the world. And you know, not to paint with too broad of a brush, not every single indigenous culture was working in a way that was healthy for the land, but many were. And permaculture draws on many of them, often without acknowledging it. And we're only now beginning to really tease out those distinctions of, you know, what came from these two Australian dudes and what's coming from modern science and what does modern science have to add to these practices? How can we, you know, kind of decolonize permaculture and re-engage current indigenous cultures in a meaningful and honorable way, while, you know, kind of combining it with these new things that permaculture is offering. So it's a great question, and it's a question that I think, as a community, we're currently in the process of answering.
Yeah, I know it's contentious because I've seen it around, and from a lot of the stuff you're saying, you know, I keep thinking the phrase decolonize, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I guess it's like, I mean, it's obviously not the same thing, but it's also like an issue with being a vegan. Like a lot of times I feel weary about even identifying myself as a vegan because there are so many, you know, shitty vegans out there that
right.
just like, and it's, and same with gardening, it ends up like having like this weird class divide. And even if I make less than minimum wage, I'm still part of like this fucking bourgeois culture that kind of repulses me a little bit. And
I mean, I don't know. My experience is whatever community you identify with, there's going to be assholes. There's going to be people who kind of take that name and use it for kind of greedy purposes, or, you know, kind of manipulate it in a way that just kind of makes them look good. And that's unfortunate. And I'd say at least as long as we're all trying to negotiate the inherent contradictions of trying to build a better world while living in capitalism, I think that's going to continue to happen no matter what words we throw around, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it is true. You know, there's a lot of shitty things that happen under the name of permaculture. And that's unfortunate because I still, you know, deeply, deeply believe that it has the potential to transform our relationship with each other in the world.
Because I've pretty much only been gardening in Arizona and Colorado, and so I have these books on xeriscaping. Xeriscape. And I was trying to, like, figure out, like, is xeriscaping permaculture, or is xeriscaping just, like, you know, what's the relationship between the two?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, so xeriscaping, and it's X-E-R-I. A lot of people say zero, but it's actually xeriscaping. It came out of the desert Southwest, I think in the 80s and 90s, as a way of gardening with very little water, with the water that was available. And generally, what people were interested in gardening was mostly ornamental stuff. So they would use a lot of native plants as well as plants from deserts in other places around the world to make these really pretty looking gardens with lots of colorful flowers and cacti and stuff like that. So in the sense that we're gardening in a way that doesn't harm the earth and probably actually improves the ecosystem, yeah, I would say xeriscaping is permaculture. I think where it might fall a little short, or where permaculture has to add to it, is saying, yes, we can grow all these pretty flowers, and we can also grow edible berries, and we can also grow salad greens, and we can also, you know, introduce animals into the system, and we can also introduce bees into the system. And so xeriscaping, I think, is a great start, and it's much better than, you know, having a water-hogging lawn. But I think it's just part of the picture.
That's interesting. So xeriscaping is actually what, you know, an aspect of permaculture in Colorado. But if you were a permaculture person in Louisiana, you wouldn't be doing xeriscaping. You'd be doing some whole other shit.
Yeah, I mean, unless, you know, in 70 years, Louisiana turns into a desert.
You'd be doing underwaterscaping. You'd be, like, forming
right,
that.
Right. Exactly. No, but I think you bring up a good point, right, that permaculture, a lot of people confuse the techniques of permaculture with the practice of permaculture, And really what makes permaculture so vital and so powerful is the fact that it can encompass an infinite number of techniques, right? So permaculture is not a chicken tractor. It's not an herb spiral. It's not a greenhouse. Those are all the end result of this process. You know, permaculture, sometimes people say permaculture is a verb. It's not a noun, right? And so depending on where you live and how much rainfall that place gets, and whether it's a city or rural, and whether, you know, the people living in that community are, you know, what ethnicity they are, how much money they make, what kinds of things they like to eat, all of those things affect the end result, the end strategies that you're going to choose to use. And so permaculture could look like literally anything as long as it's meeting human needs while restoring ecosystem health.
That's cool. How'd you get into all this shit?
So I, like I said, I went away to college. I was studying out in New York City and took this class called Urban Environmentalism that really opened my eyes to the scope of our ecological crisis and how it, you know, pretty much all of the different things that are destroying the earth have their roots in our current economic system. And so I became really involved, you know, more on that activist tip, right, of trying to tell people not to drive as much and, you know, basically that whole finger wagging thing. And then realized that, you know, an even better way of doing things was to take all these solutions that have been floating around in our culture for, you know, in our own culture for 40, 50 years, and certainly in indigenous cultures for thousands of years, and start to create demonstrations of those. And that led me to permaculture. And I took a permaculture design course, which is the kind of official initiation into being a permaculturalist. I took that in 2008, which was my last semester of college. And then basically, you know, moved back to Denver and started figuring out what that looks like here and got involved in the grow house and started teaching. And it's been a wild ride ever since.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's like I'm friends with so many of your friends, and I've just soaked up so much shit from all of y'all, having never had to go to any of those things. Like I got Jerusalem artichokes, I got yarrow, mm-hmm. I got all this shit, and I'm like, woo! So, you know, thank you for picking up the torch, man. It's amazing to have all this information around and just have it accessible.
Yeah, well, thank you for spreading the information. And, you know, I mean, I feel like, you know, we all have our niche to play in this ecosystem of making a better world, right? And I'm just kind of stumbling along trying to figure out the best thing that I could do for my community. And I definitely see you doing that too. And the great thing is when we have these interconnections in our community where we both feel like we're getting the good end of the deal, right? That's when we know we're building something special.
Totally. I can't believe we're like halfway through the interview and I haven't even got to ask you about your book yet. It's hilarious. So,
yeah.
Well, so you have a new book coming out. What title did you end up with?
Yeah, right. So I went back and forth with a bunch of different things and got a lot of great input from my community. And what we're going with is we're just going simple. It's going to be called Social Permaculture, 100 Patterns That Transform Community. And so, you know, the idea behind this book is that it's taking all of these lessons that permaculture has to offer based on natural systems and thriving indigenous cultures from throughout the world. And instead of just applying it to how we grow food, this book is specifically focused on the culture aspect of permaculture. So, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about how we make decisions in groups and what kinds of economic systems might replace what I call the anti-market system that, you know, a lot of people call neoliberalism or free market capitalism. I spent a lot of time talking about the patterns that we're finding tend to work more often than not in activist and protest and revolutionary movements. So it's broken down into this series of 100 different kind of really short little entries, and each one of those is what I call a pattern. It's this solution that tends to work in many different contexts. And so the idea is for people using this book to use it as kind of a reference that they can kind of pick and choose from these 100 patterns and definitely make their own patterns from their own experience and use it as a tool to literally design social movements and social structures that are much more community-based and grassroots and just.
Is the, I mean, I don't want you to give away your, you know, intellectual property here. Are there any, like, you know, things like on the tip of your tongue that are like jumping out, like this, here's a really cool example of a economic thing or a...
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, let's see, what's a good one, for example? So one of the very kind of philosophical, you know, high level patterns that I talk about is this thing called subsidiarity. And it's a concept that I think most of us working for a better world kind of know in our bones. We might not have heard the word for it. I only heard the word like a year or two ago. But it's basically this idea that our social problems should be managed at the smallest level possible, at the smallest practical level. So, you know, if we're in a community that's dealing with issues of crime and mistrust between members of that community, the kind of status quo solution is to, you know, have this citywide police force. And if that doesn't work, to bring in the National Guard, right? Whereas subsidiarity would say, let's start with other people in that community. Let's start with the people on that block and do things like restorative justice, which is another pattern, by the way, and see if we can work it out within the community. And then if that doesn't work, then maybe we can go up to the level of the neighborhood or, you know, the city, but that the best and most durable way of solving our problems is at the smallest scale possible. So that's like a very broad pattern, right? And then there's these like very specific patterns. Things like, you know, I talk in the economic section about heirloom currencies, right? So we live right now in a monoculture of currency. And that monoculture is called the U.S. dollar. It also goes by other names like the euro and the yen. But they're all basically the same currency. They're created by central banks. They charge interest. They're, by the way they're designed, they have to grow. And that creates this kind of continual growth imperative. Well, you know, we know that monocultures don't work in ecosystems. So why would they work in our economic systems? So this idea of heirloom currencies is creating a polyculture of lots of different ways of exchanging information and knowledge and goods and services with each other. And each one of them is suited for a different means of interaction, right? So more and more of us are becoming familiar with cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Faircoin. That's one kind of heirloom currency for one kind of exchange. And then there's all these other local currencies. There's things like time banks, community loan funds, there's mutual credit clearing systems. There's all these different ways of designing currencies to meet the actual needs of exchange we have rather than feeding into this kind of all-encompassing dollar. So that's like a really kind of more specific pattern of this is something you can implement in your community.
Wow, that's fucking dope, man. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff, you know, seeing all these patterns together in one place and realizing all the connections between them. And, you know, I long ago gave up on trying to make this a comprehensive thing, right? Like this is, my hope is that this work of these 100 patterns is just sparking the idea for other people that we can all start to collaboratively come up with a whole language of patterns of hundreds or thousands that we're putting together as a community and sharing all of these ideas that work that we can kind of recontextualize, remix in different ways to create the solutions that we need.
And you know, bringing it back to, you know, this idea of revolution, you know, revolution is not like this definitive end point where you, you know, kill the dictator and then like we're all free. You know, we have a whole, you know, culture that we have to reimagine before we can even think about, you know, what it looks like after, in my opinion.
Right.
And these are the kinds of conversations I've been having with myself or with my friends and just trying to figure out like, okay, what is it really, you know, what does it really look like? And this book, it sounds like you've been doing a lot of that thinking, man. That sounds incredible. I'm super excited to read it now. First I was like, what's this book going to be about? And I was like, oh shit. Like,
probably. Yeah.
And I like that it has totally... like the kind of ADD sort of like, here's one thing, here's another, you know?
Right. And, you know, I'm that way, too. I think we're all that way these days where who has the time to read 400 pages cover to cover? I mean, I try to, but it takes me weeks. But this is something that you can kind of just flip to a random page and learn about this crazy like decision making process, and then you know come back a month later and learn about zone analysis and permaculture and what that means and how that applies to understanding your community. And so it's just these little nuggets of inspiration that hopefully, you know, start to build on each other and give you the tools you need to kind of create revolutionary projects.
So you just said zone analysis. Do you mean like 5B? Is that the kind of zone analysis you're talking about? Like climate zones?
No, actually. So what you're talking about is the USDA cold hardiness zones. And those are like definitely helpful for understanding what plants will grow in your climate and what won't. But zone in the kind of permaculture lingo is this idea of, looking at the things around you that need the most work and that you get the most out of and placing them closest to you. And then the things that are more kind of self-sustaining can be farther away from you. So in the garden, for example, right, you want like your lettuce, all your greens that you want to go to like every day and harvest a few. Those should be like right outside the kitchen door. So you can just clip them, wash them off, put them in a salad. But then things like a fruit tree, which, you know, you probably only need to visit once every few weeks, once a month, something like that. That can be maybe more at the far corner of your yard because you don't need to be, you know, you're not walking forth every day. So that's like in the garden. But then I take that idea and apply it to our communities. What are the different scales of communities who we exist around and amongst? There's like these kind of small, intimate family-sized communities, which might be our blood family, but it might be like our best friend or our romantic partner. And then there's another zone outside of that that's like our close collaborators. And another zone outside of that that's like our acquaintances and so on and so on. And each one of those zones has different ways of organizing, different ways of making decisions, different ways of working together that, you know, you can look at evolutionary psychology. You can look at how monkeys do this shit and learn about it. And then obviously look at how other cultures have done it. And there's a lot to learn there in terms of the size of our groups and the different organizing techniques we're using based on who these groups are and how we're trying to relate to them.
Huh. You know, it's really funny because we share Man Mantis as like, you know, he's your old friend.
Yeah, totally.
And I know y'all went to an experience-based middle school, right? Or elementary school.
Yeah, both. Yep.
What do you have to say about education, about experience-based learning, and, you know, has that influence, has that played a huge part of your life that
It totally has, and I feel like the school I went to, which was all about kind of self-directed learning, we went on all kinds of field trips into the wilderness and stuff like that, totally, like, you know, shaped my neural connections in such a way that when I learned about permaculture, I like instantly got it. You know, I was already a systems thinker. I just didn't know it. And, you know, not to say that that way of learning is right for everybody, but it was right for me. And I think it's right for a lot more people than have the opportunity to experience it. And so I was actually going to write a lot about that form of education and just, you know, applying these ideas to how we teach and educate each other in the book, and I realized it was just outside of my my expertise. And so I'm like, all right, I either need to leave that to someone else or do, you know, 4 more years of research and write another book on it. But totally that kind of experiential education, peer-to-peer education, instead of this hierarchical, like, teacher and student thing, which, you know, has its place, but really looking at all these other models of education are just as important to this language of patterns that I'm hoping to develop.
Yeah, because there are some problematic things, because it's super experimental with a lot of this experience-based stuff, and it seems like it changes all the time. And I've seen situations, maybe not with you, but I've seen other situations where, you know, it doesn't work for some people. And for me, I think it would have worked for me because I fucked up in school, and it wasn't. It just didn't speak to me because I was just fucking an automaton. Like, like, so what if my handwriting sucks? There's going to be computers in 10 years. Don't you realize?
Right.
Oh, God. Okay, let me just ask you some nerdy gardening questions.
Great.
What What are some of your favorite medicinal plants to grow?
In terms of medicinal for our own bodies?
However you want to interpret that. Yeah, I meant medicinal for our bodies. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, great. So a lot of the ones, and I, first off, you know, I've read a lot and taught with a lot of people who are experts at herbalism, and I'm not. I can grow a lot of these plants, but I'm not an expert in preparing them for herbal remedies, so I'm just going to, you know, put that out there as a disclaimer. But what I will say, from what I've grown and other things that I've used from my community, comfrey is a really incredible plant for healing wounds. You can make a salve out of it. And, you know, I like burned my hip a few months ago on like a big cast iron pan. And it was like this nasty, you know, blister type thing. And I had this comfrey salve that I put on it every day. And, you know, that thing healed in like a week. Whereas I feel like without it, it would have taken 3-4 weeks and left a scar and, you know, all this gross stuff. So comfrey is pretty powerful.
Wait, is comfrey yarrow?
Nope, yarrow is a different one. Okay. Comfrey has like really, really big fuzzy leaves that just grow proliferously. And it happens to also be really great in the garden and has a lot of great ecological benefits as well. Yarrow is also great in the garden, goes well with a lot of these polycultures and has lots of different medicinal properties. Another one that I use a lot is valerian. It's a natural sedative, the root is. And so it's, you know, you can grow the root, dig it up, make a tincture out of it. And, you know, if you're having trouble sleeping or something like that, it's a good thing to have.
It's pretty, yeah. Too. That's a pretty, pretty
It's flower. A very pretty plant, yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people know about echinacea and what that does for your immune system. I don't know how many people know that that grows really great in the climate that you and I live in. This kind of high desert climate. So that's another amazing herbal remedy. So,
are these all perennials that you're listing off?
Yes, they are. Some of them die back in the spring, so you won't see them above the ground. But then they'll come back when it warms up, and they'll grow back. But yeah, all those three that I just listed are perennials.
Cool, man. Yeah, I just threw some echinacea in the ground, but I'm like, I didn't know you could grow valerian here.
It does pretty well here. It actually grows even better up in the mountains where a lot of people forage it.
That's cool, man. So here's another question I have just about vegan gardening in general. Like, I do really well with everything except producing protein. And like, you know, I have all these pole beans, snap peas, and like, it doesn't, like, I could have half of my garden with beans growing all the way up to my roof, and I still wouldn't have enough protein to feed myself for a week in the fall. Like, how will vegans survive the apocalypse, man?
That's a good question. and, you know, they're definitely, the first thing I would say is go perennial. Right. So look at what are the perennial crops that are providing sources of protein that are going to give you a bigger and bigger yield every year instead of you having to do all this work of planting more peas and stuff like that. And so along those lines, you know, things like chestnuts and acorns, even things like Siberian pea shrub, which is a, you know, it's like a pea, but it's a tree and grows really well here.
Really?
I would recommend as vegan sources of protein. But that being said, honestly, like permaculture, there's certainly plenty of permaculture vegans. But I would say the majority of permaculturalists are of the opinion that it's pretty necessary to have animals in the system in some form or another, even if you're not eating those animals, to have a, really kind of closed loop regenerative from an ecological perspective system. Right. So that could mean, you know, grazing bison, that could mean rabbits that you keep as pets, that could mean any number of different things. But, you know, we say if we have all this abundance of species around us and we can provide, you know, many different kinds of animals with really healthy, happy lives, as opposed to, you know, the really horrendous lives that most livestock currently have, and integrate them into the system, then why would we not do that?
Yeah, my sister, she was a vegan and vegetarian for most of her life. She lives in Golden. And she, you know, she started getting chickens and, you know, was just eating their eggs and started eating their eggs. And then she started getting ducks. And then, like, there was this one duck that was just raping all these other ducks. So she was like, fuck it, I'm going to eat that motherfucker. And then, you know, and then, like, when you have chickens that are dying and she's just, you know, started eating these things. And I don't know, it's similar to what you're saying. It's like, if you're going to have this whole system, it's like, what is she just going to, she has to get rid of that duck. She killed it, you know, if an animal's dying and she knows it had a good life, she's like, okay, you're fucking Thanksgiving, you know? And to me, like, as I'm a vegan and, you know, I really care about the well-being of animals first and foremost. But I if the shit hit the fan, I'd be eating eggs. I'd have to, at the very least. One of the first time I ever saw one of these setups is at your house. Mm-hmm. Not your house, at the grow house, I should say. The aquaponic.
Oh, yep, totally. The aquaponics, where the fish is the fertilizer for the plants.
And the kale and the chard had leaves that were, like, bigger than ferns in the Pacific Northwest. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of shit you're talking about.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That shows you what that kind of deep integration of animals into the system can do. And, you know, we happen to be growing tilapia in that system, but the results would be exactly the same if you were just doing koi, which nobody eats. You know, people grow them ornamentally and they live for 50 years. So again, it's not necessarily about raising animals to eat the animals, but the truth is, and it's really about their shit. Like, the waste of animals is the best source of fertilizer for the plants that we all need to eat that we've ever been able to find.
So are you saying if I built, like, Mr. Miyagi style canals in my yard and harvested the shit from the koi, that's not wasteful?
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, if you harvested that shit, and, you know, if you look up something called chinampas, this was one of the most, you know, per square foot, the most productive agricultural systems ever was done by the Aztecs in, you know, 700-800 years ago, where they had these, like, canals where they raised fish, that in between every canal was this little hill where they raised trees and plants, and every so often they would dredge up the canal, take all the fish waste that had settled to the bottom, pile it on top, and, you know, raise up the height of those hills. And so they were, you know, getting all their protein in the water and then all of their, you know, vitamins and minerals from the plants that were growing because of that fish waste. And it was just this really, really tightly integrated system that worked on so many levels.
Wow, man. This should be... I feel like I could just go on for, like, 6 hours with this. Let me ask you this. What do you think of vertical gardening? Is that bullshit?
Yeah, a lot of it's overblown, honestly. You know, when we're talking about vertical gardening in the form of, like, these, you know, 30-story skyscrapers that are growing all of the food for an entire neighborhood or whatever, I mean, a lot of that is just falling into the same trap of technological futurism, placing all of our faith in some magic technology that we've been falling into for centuries. And the truth is that, you know, how much energy does it take to build that skyscraper? How much electricity does it take to run all of the machines to keep that going, right? How many rare earth metals needed to be mined to power the solar panels that you're claiming are making this thing sustainable? So, you know, it's not to say that there isn't a place for greenhouses and maybe even multi-story greenhouses in some cases. But I don't think that's, you know, the kind of multi-level, super high-tech route is not the route that most permaculturalists are all about.
What about just taking, like, pallets and, you know, stuffing them with, like, potato sacks and growing herbs and succulents in them? Have you ever messed around with that?
Oh, yeah. I love messing around with that. And, yeah, I mean, if you're talking about just vertical gardening as literally kind of getting more per square foot by stacking things than 100%. You know, I love to do the chicken wire tomato or potato cage, where you just kind of keep piling on dirt as the potato stalks get higher. And the higher you pile the dirt, the more tomatoes grow, you know, out of what used to be the stalks or potatoes. I keep saying tomatoes. And, you know, just stacking things in terms of, you know, you'll have a fruit tree and underneath the fruit tree, you'll have like a little shrub that produces berry and adds nitrogen to the soil for the fruit tree. And then underneath that berry shrub, you'll have a comfrey plant to add other nutrients and heal your skin. And underneath the comfrey plant, you'll have some strawberries to keep the weeds off of the ground, right? Like all of that is vertical gardening as well and maximizing your space. So yeah, that's the kind of vertical gardening that I can get down with.
Wow, do most berries add nitrogen?
No, not most berries, but there happen to be, gosh, half a dozen different species that grow really well here in Colorado that do. So things like the goumi, G-O-U-M-I, or what else? There's sea buckthorn is another really cool one. There's, let's see, I'm trying to think of what other... There's
Do currants?
Currants are not nitrogen fixers, okay. No, although I would definitely recommend them for here in Colorado. There is the buffalo berry is another good example. So, yeah, there's a good, you know, four or five different species of nitrogen fixing berry bushes that grow really well here.
Wow, that's amazing. I was just like out in the woods up in... fucking what's that, Turquoise Lake, have you ever been there?
Oh yeah, I love that place outside of Leadville.
Oh man, I just can't get enough of that place, to be honest. But I'm just like walking around and I keep seeing all these currant bushes. I'm like, man, I'm about to dig some of these motherfuckers up and take them home. You know, just the babies, you know.
Yeah totally.
But yeah, I don't know, what are there any other like experimental gardening things that you're working on right now that you're geeking out about?
Yeah. You know, a lot of what I'm geeking out about these days is, you know, like I was talking about stuff with the water systems. So I'm really hyped up about gray water systems, specifically laundry to landscape, where you take the wastewater that's coming out of your laundry machine and pump it directly into garden beds that are growing fruit trees and stuff like that. You know, it takes the right detergent and your laundry machine has to be placed in the right place. But if all that stuff lines up, then you can really, you know, take so much water that would otherwise be going to the sewer and really turbocharge the water that your plants are getting. And actually all of the stuff that comes out of the washing machine that you don't want on your clothes is generally the stuff that's really good for the plants.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm all about that. And then, there's something called self-watering containers, or people call them wicking beds, where you're basically creating this kind of sealed chamber underneath the soil that's just kind of filled with water. And then you have these like little wicks that dip down into that chamber that bring the water up through capillary action into the soil above it, and give the plants as much water as they need, and that water isn't evaporating to the air. And so you can make that in as little a thing as like two yogurt containers or as large as, you know, these huge raised beds. And so that's another really awesome water-saving thing that, you know, you could hook that up to a downspout and never even have to put water in it. And that, you know, rainwater just sits there until the plants need it.
Wow, that's amazing. Is this still a felony to trap water in Colorado?
Yeah, not. It actually just changed. And Colorado was the last state in the country to have harvesting of rainwater be illegal, which is, you know, that's a story for another time. But basically, the governor just signed a law that now anybody is allowed to harvest up to 255-gallon barrels of rainwater at their home. So, you know, 110 gallons, it's still not a ton, but it's definitely enough to, you know, add some good stuff to your veggie garden and whatnot. So I think, you know, we're moving in the right direction, but the laws and the politics around this are, like, so crazy that, you know, it's amazing that we've made it this far.
Well, you know, we're getting towards the end of my questions here. Just wondering, are there any big names in the field of permaculture that you'd like to shout out, like for people who are more interested in learning more about this style of this philosophy and this style of gardening?
Yeah, totally. So yeah, I'll just name, you know, some of the mentors and colleagues that I have that have inspired me, and kind of give honor to those folks. So, you know, I was trained in permaculture by a guy named Andrew Faust, who does amazing things in New York City, kind of showing what permaculture looks like in the heart of the city. He was actually trained by a guy named Peter Bain, who I had the good fortune of teaching side by side with for 4 years, and is just a really, really wise, amazing guy. I've studied also with Starhawk, who a lot of people might know outside of the permaculture community because she's done incredible activism work and spirituality work for many years, but she's also a permaculturalist.
That's not the same Starhawk from out here, Colleen.
Nope, different okay. one. Okay. Yep. No, this Starhawk is based in California, and she's, you know, 60s, in her 60s. But who else? I've worked with this guy, Eric Tonesmeyer, who's done really incredible stuff around the science of forest gardening. He just came out with a book last year called The Carbon Farming Toolkit, showing how basically if we plant enough trees in the right way, we can reverse global warming and grow all of the calories that we need. It's an incredible book. And let's see, Pandora Thomas is at the forefront of this work of what I call decolonizing permaculture. She is one of the founders of the Black Permaculture Network, and has just done some really, really inspiring projects around permaculture and social justice. Those are just a few of the names, but there's, you know, literally dozens of some of the most inspiring organizers and teachers I know are involved in permaculture.
Is there any like a book, like a couple books that you think people should read, or like?
Yeah. So, for a lot of people, their first book in permaculture is one called Gaia's Garden, GAIA'S. And that's good if you're just trying to, you know, take these ideas and apply them literally to your own backyard to, you know, kind of growing more food, growing more perennials on a backyard scale. There's Peter Bain has something called the Permaculture Handbook that's more about doing this at the small farm scale, so like half an acre to 5 acres. There is a really short book called People and Permaculture by a British gal named Luby McNamara that talks about how permaculture applies interpersonally in more of the social realm. Those are, I think, a few really accessible places to plug in.
Man, I fucking just learned a shit ton, dude. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for hitting me up. I always love chatting about this shit, and I definitely hope that the folks listening to this get some inspiration out of it.
Do you know when your book comes out?
Yeah, it's going to be out in the spring of 2017. April, May, something like that. It's coming out through North Atlantic Books. And I'll be doing a book tour. So, you know, if anybody across the country is interested in hosting a workshop or a reading or anything like that, I'd definitely love to get in touch and we can start connecting.
Well, how would people get in touch with you if they want to book you for your book tour or if they just want to follow you in general?
Yeah. So, my email address is wildgreenyonder@gmail.com. And they can hit me up that way. I have a website that's peoplepattern.org, and there's a contact form on there that people can use, and that has just kind of right now the bare bones of the stuff that's going to be in the book, but I'll be adding more and more to that as the book comes out. Those are the best ways to connect.
And you're not on Twitter or any of that shit?
I'm not on Twitter. I am on Facebook, so, you know, just Adam Brock, you can find me there, and that's another great way to get in touch.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. I don't know. Have a fucking awesome summer, man.
Hell yeah. You too, man. Thanks. Thanks for the connection, and look forward to connecting more in the future.
Hell yeah.